All right, we're in Joshua 3 and 4 today. If you want to go ahead and turn there, we'll do a fair amount of reading of those two chapters. Reminder, since we record these, I feel like I have to say this every time now. I'm using Ralph Davis's commentary on the book of Joshua that is really excellent as my sort of outline and how to organize the lessons. And if I look like I'm reading something that I'm quoting and I forget to say it, it's probably from him. He's the commentator that I'm quoting the most in this class. We made it to chapter 3 and 4, and we've sort of laid out the problem before us. We have these wonderful promises from God. We have promise of a land and rest, of an inheritance, of becoming a great nation. We have proofs from God of his power and his love for us. He has seen us through the parting of the sea. This is so nice to see y'all. It's like, caught me off guard. Glad you're here. But it wasn't us that saw that, was it? It was the last generation. And they've all died out. And it's been hundreds of years in between promise and fulfillment. And Moses is dead. And we look in front of us, and in between us and the land is a river. An unforgiving, powerful river. How are we going to get across? One of the neat things I've mentioned about the way Joshua is written, a lot of literary care and attention. And this bothers us sometimes as Western readers. When we're reading a book that's telling a historical event, a story, we get frustrated because we expect the most important thing to be the timeline, that the story is going to go in exactly the order that it occurred in history. And that's not the way Eastern writers captured stories. They put the most important theme or moment in the center of a story to highlight that, like we saw last week in Joshua 2, they're way less concerned with the linearity of the narrative the way we are. And so you'll read some modern commentaries more skeptical about the divine origins of the Bible on Joshua, and they'll have a lot of problems with chapters 3 and 4 because they'll say you just can't line up these events in the sequence that they occur in the text. That's a feature. That's a feature. That's exactly how it's supposed to be written. Because what you'll find as we read through these chapters are two things. One, there is an amazing ability to build suspense. The author is really good at ratcheting up the tension so that we start to feel what they feel. And if you think about one of the purposes of capturing biblical history in these stories, it's got to be to get us alongside our fathers and mothers in the faith so that we have some experiential sense of what's going through their minds, of what's happening in their hearts as these events are unfolding. It's way more important than did this take place an hour before that took place. The power of the story in the power of God, the goodness of God, the trustworthiness of God, it's way more important that we are mentally and emotionally prepared to receive that message than that we could write down a chronology of events from start to finish exactly the way they occurred. So this is what you would want to see and what you would expect to see in biblical writing. So the first thing I said is there is a good deal of suspense built into this story. And then one way that that's really ratcheted up, almost to a frustrating level for us, is you get to sort of the crux of the story, this crucial moment where there's the potential crossing over, and then the author puts in these seemingly insignificant, trivial details as kind of an excursus, like, who cares about the weather report right now? We're getting ready to cross this river. And again, it's for this tension. It's for this sense of how they would have felt. And then the speech, the teaching moment that Joshua will give that sort of pushes the people along in faithfulness, that's saved for the very end. It doesn't fit chronologically. It's the exclamation point on the end of the story. Here is what the people heard and knew about God that that moved them, that persuaded them toward faithfulness throughout this. And so at the very end of chapter 4, verses 21 to 24, you've got this speech from Joshua, and that really is the author's way of saying everything you just heard about this narrative, here's what you're supposed to take away from it. Here's what's supposed to be cemented in your heart. And I forgot to mention it last week, but the author does the exact same thing on the Rahab story. When you think about the Rahab story and you think about the teaching that you've gotten or you've read about over the years, or you think about when the Rahab story comes up in theological conversation, why does that story come up? What's the argument people are usually having where the Rahab argument becomes part of the discussion?
Lying's okay.
Is it okay to lie? Rahab lies to the spies. She misleads the spies. And so that story is used very often in conversations about that. Why didn't I bring it up last week? Why did I forget? Because it's not the point of the story at all. And the entire story is written to make this completely different point, where the text creates this greater than sign leading you to an exclamation point about the sovereignty of God, and then building, following backwards in line as if to say, hey, here's the bright shining neon lights. God is sovereign. God's in control. That's what's important about these stories. It's not some of the things that we can tend to get hung up on. So let's talk about the structure and look at this text together. Andrew, are you there? If you would read chapter 3, 1 through 6.
Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim. And they came to the Jordan, he and all the people of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priest, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. Yet there shall be a distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it, in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. And Joshua said to the priests, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people.
Davis calls this section Perception Matters, the perception of Yahweh's work. The verses we just read bring up the Ark of the Covenant. If you scan your eyes through chapter 3 and 4, can you see that phrase, Ark of the Covenant, a few more times?
Yes.
You see it 17 times. 17 times in two chapters, the Ark of the Covenant is called out. Attention is brought to it. What does the Ark of the Covenant represent? What did that signifier mean in the Old Testament?
It's God's presence among his people.
Exactly. God's presence with his people. And that became particularly important when his people were on the move. And the ark could also be on the move. It's a portable representation of God's presence with them. And so as they prepare for this great event, the crossing over into the land that they've been promised, the Ark of the Covenant, and let's now say two things about it. One is, it's with them. So it's not too hard to figure out what that's supposed to signify, right? God is going to be with them. We talked about that last week and the week before as a critical theme of Joshua. How can God's people live without fear despite the uncertainty? Despite how long it's been since the promises were made? Despite the fact that there's a raging river in front of us, despite the fact that Moses is dead, despite the fact that second generation religion is incredibly tenuous, how can God's people live without fear? And Joshua says again and again, God is with you. And so now we have the Ark of the Covenant. God is with his people as they will do this thing to go into the land. Where physically is the Ark of the Covenant, though? Is it way behind God's people? It's before them. It's actually way out in front of them. Why? Who will deliver the people into the promised land? God will do it. God will lead his people. You can see something in front of you that looks impossible, and yet God has called you to do it. This happens on a micro scale in our lives all the time. You can see something in front of you where, to human perception, you say, faithfulness will not work here. Faithfulness will not get me what is best for me. Don't you say that sometimes in your own mind? You say, in this situation, to get what's best for me, to get what's safe, or to get what makes me well-respected, or to get me security or comfort, to get me what I need, faithfulness will not work. And God is out in front of us saying, I will get you what you need. I will lead you. Faithfulness is the only thing that will work, because I go before you and I make this path. God will lead his people into Canaan. Something else that's interesting about this is there's a distance there between God and his people. The ark is out in front of them, and there are rules about how close they could come to it, and they certainly can't touch it. People need to see, we need to see what God will do. And we need to see where God is going to follow him. Now, thankfully, we don't have to look around for an ark or a pillar of fire or a cloud of smoke. God revealed himself in his word. He reveals himself in the manifested word in Christ. God has shown us where he is going and what faithfulness looks like. But it is not something that we would find ourselves. It is not going our own way. And that sounds, we say that a lot coming up in Christianity, and it can start to sound trivial about, I'm not going to go my own way, I'm going to go God's way, and eventually you kind of glaze over and roll your eyes. And then I think in the Christian life, you sort of come back around to that a little bit, where you realize just how destructive and bad your own way is. I think it's easy sometimes. You sort of get on fire for God maybe early on, and then you settle into this routine that you think is the normal Christian life, that's sort of this cooperation between me and God. God, I give you some of my time, some of my attention, some of my activities, and there are these other things that I'm going to cooperate with you, which means I'm going to do what I want to do and pretend that you've blessed it. And at some point, we've got to come to recognize, now, our way actually is really, really bad. Our way is death. Our way is not just disobedient to God. Our way is bad for us. The greatest thing we can figure out by the Holy Spirit is that our way is bad for us. Even if I'm acting, this is not careful speech, but even if I just want to act selfishly and do what's best for me, what is actually objectively best for me is faithfulness to God. It's that death to self and life with him and for him. And so people needed to see what path to take, and they needed to see God's, Yahweh's great act of faithfulness, great act of promise keeping out in front of them. Some translations are better than others here. It's not a big deal, but if you've got the RSV or the NIV, it can sort of imply in the text that the reason they needed the distance from the ark was the holiness. The reason they needed the distance from the ark was the visibility. It's a giant mass of people that all need to be able to see what God himself is going to do. There's not going to be rumors in the ranks of, did you see what Joshua did? There's going to be rumors in the ranks of, did you see what God did? Did you see the way that God led us? So they needed some distance for their perception to be correct. They also needed to sanctify themselves. Verse 5, sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow Yahweh will do wonders among you. There's a encouragement here that God's people need to be prepared for him to act. That God's people need to be ready spiritually, emotionally, mentally ready for God to act. And as I read that this week, I thought, isn't that what I'm supposed to be in prayer? And is that what I am? Isn't that what I'm supposed to be in worship? And is that what I am? Am I ready for God to act? When I bring needs before God in prayer, am I bringing them as somebody who's checking a box or going through the motions or following a routine or exercising an atomic habit? Or am I going through the work of prayer as somebody who is expecting God to act and preparing myself for that? If you've done any reading on prayer, and we've got a couple of great books on the book table I know many of you have read, the most important thing we learn about prayer is that prayer doesn't change God. Who does prayer change?
Us.
Prayer changes us. The purpose of prayer is that it changes us. And what if part of that change is I need to be ready for God to act? I need to think in a sober-minded way about where I need and want God to act. I need to think in a biblical way about what it would look like for God to act and what my perception of what would be good for God to do. And I need to pray boldly for those things. And I need to pray, thy will be done. Why? Because a lot of times I'm wrong about what is good and how God needs to act. And so when I pray, not my will, but yours, I am getting ready for God to act. And the people are told to sanctify themselves. Get ready for what God is going to do. It gives you the right perspective on the event itself. Think about all the different ways. Some of you have been on the Lead with Character trip, and Steve May makes the point that if you think about the Exodus story, doesn't it make a pretty big difference if the Exodus story is written by Moses or it's written by Pharaoh? How the story's told is pretty different. The faithfulness of a covenant-keeping God who delivers his people from bondage versus Pharaoh's version of that story, which is a bunch of recalcitrant slaves, discontent with the lot they'd been given in life, who through a series of natural disasters managed to escape. Pretty different stories. And part of getting ourselves ready for the work that God is going to do is preparing ourselves to rightly interpret and appreciate what God is doing. We have a big advantage. We have lots of big advantages, salvation chief among them, but we have a big advantage over the materialists in this world, because when stuff happens, we get to think through it as part of a grander narrative. What might God be doing? And on hard things, that's really challenging, and we may not come to the answer. But we know the question has an answer, because we know God is doing something. We know God is acting. We know God is at work. We know God is doing this for his glory and for our good, good of his people. We can't appreciate that God acts and how God acts if we aren't prepared to view life through that lens of God is the divine actor. God is good, faithful, covenant-keeping. God is sovereign. Put all these doctrines together, and the result of it is God is the divine actor who's at work, and I need to get my heart ready to interpret what God is doing, to appreciate that God is acting. Davis says, if we're not impressed with the grandeur of the living God in worship, is it because we have not prepared ourselves to see him as such? Could it be that we even fail to detect the Lord's marvelous working in the routine affairs of our lives simply because we have not prepared ourselves to see or even to expect it? There's a great invitation here. There's a great opportunity for us to live in a way that is richer, that is fuller, because we're ready to watch all of life in expectation and anticipation of a God who acts, of a God who works. Let's talk about that for a minute. What are some examples of times where you went into a situation looking for God to work, and so you saw it and you were able to appreciate it? Or an example of a time where you later realized you should have been looking for God to work, and it would have given you a completely different perspective on that situation. So let's hear some examples of that. Y'all get what I'm asking? I told one as my funny story at the start of class. about the Lord's kindness in relieving stress, relieving the likelihood that Kate was going to miss the first day of school and my wife was going to have good reason to be mad at me. Because what I'm looking for is for God to act in ways that favor his people. That's my default posture, is how is God acting in a way that favors his people? What are other examples or ones you should have seen? I got lots of those too.
I think there are small ones that I see in my week where the kids, you know, interrupt my task or routine that I want to accomplish, and then you realize, like, no, this was a really important conversation we needed to have, or I needed to be around for, you know, for whatever reason. And it's those interruptions that it's all about perspective.
Isn't that a category I bet most of us have experienced, where you're in a place and you sort of can't figure out, why am I even in this place? Why was I even here? And then there's this one moment, that one conversation or that one act of service or that one moment of kindness where you realize God put me in this place for that thing. Might be more, but I saw that thing that was needed. That person needed that act of kindness or that conversation or that good word. Any others?
I just think of right now, my season of life, you know, looking for the next journey and things, and I've been praying a lot about that. First time I haven't worked, right, in the fall, that kind of thing. And like at the gym, I go to the Y, someone that I had been in a group with a long time ago shows up, I'm walking on the track, and starts talking to me. She's retired, and mentions a Bible study that she's going to, what I like to, you know, I mean, and then another thing that she volunteered. I mean, just to me, it's those kinds of things, right? I've been praying about, like, and then he just shows up, right, you know?
And they feel, a lot of times they feel small. And to me, that sort of makes them better. God favored me in such an insignificant detail.
It's that he is with us every day. Yeah.
But don't we also kind of have to have the perspective that he's favored me in this way, and I, in my finite brain, can fathom it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's infinite ways that he's blessing me that I can't understand and I can't see.
Correct.
And so I had vast periods of my life where everything clicked. Everything happened. God came through. And then I have seasons of life when that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
I can't say that God turned off.
You're exactly right. He's doing the same thing he was doing before. He's doing in a way that is harder for my mind, or even impossible for my mind, to see how it's the same. And so I have to call back to those Ebenezers of the same faithful God and faithful God and faithful God did not suddenly become unfaithful, but he executed his faithfulness in a way that is emotionally devastating to me. And yet, faithful, 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 he didn't suddenly change. That's what's so comforting, why he says he doesn't change. Because we would sure think he would. And so I find a lot in prayer. I'll go into prayer so certain about what ought to be. And I will come out of prayer with a great deal of humility about what ought to be. Because the Lord, by his Spirit, will sort of teach you, he's playing on a couple billion levels deeper than I can consider. It doesn't stop me from asking for what I want. It does not stop me. But it does create the humility of, if God does something else, and quite often he does, it is better. And we can even honestly say to God, I believe this is better, and this is not what I want at all, and I still don't want this, and I don't like this. A significant portion of the Psalms are filled with those. That's one of the great blessings of the Psalms for us, is they talk to God a way that we would be afraid to talk to God if we didn't read it in the Psalms. All right, let's look at the next section. This is, he labels, the exaltation of Yahweh's servant. Pam, will you read chapter 3, verses 7 through 9?
The Lord said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that, as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And as for you, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan.
And Joshua said to the people of Israel, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God.
It is not a lack of faith to desire confidence-inspiring leaders. You can trust God and have a natural godly desire that those who lead you are competent and faithful and good. Those are not mutually exclusive. And so God condescends to his people here. They're going to have this totally predictable sort of crisis of confidence. You want to be the guy who follows Moses? Moses. And then you're the next guy. The next guy. And the first thing that people hear God saying to the next guy is telling him like 50 times, don't be afraid. I'm not sure that inspires confidence. Joshua, don't be afraid. Joshua, be strong and courageous. Joshua, be strong and Joshua, strong and courageous. Turn out, that works out pretty well. But it's not exactly confidence inspiring. And so God condescends to his people by exalting his servant, by putting out a man with his blessing, with his favor, and by showing the people, I am with him. I'm with you, plural, and I'm with him who will lead you. You've got a difficult thing ahead. You need to put your trust in me, and condescension to weakness, act of a good God, all these things. You should be secure, Joshua, that you are the man for this, that I am calling you. People need to have a high view of Joshua so that their spines would be strengthened to follow him. And Joshua needs to have a high view of his own calling so that he can lead confidently in faithfulness. The most confident leaders in the world fight against insecurity all the time. You have to project confidence, but a lot of times on the inside, it's, man, I wish I felt that as strongly as I just said it. People need this. Daphne and I are going this evening to the installation service of Rob Dykes, who's the new pastor at Christ Covenant in Greensboro. And Rob's been on the job for a month now. And so you think, well, why do you do an installation service? Why don't you just have a reception where you celebrate? And we will do that. But the installation service is a worship service of God and an encouragement to Rob to strengthen his spine, that the church is gathered to affirm this call, that the elders and ministers of Christ Church are gathered to lay hands on you and to do this sort of thing. You should be confident in as far as you are faithful that God has called you to this task. And it's an encouragement to the congregation. One of the things that'll happen is a charge to the congregation where they're going to be encouraged that this is the man that God has called to lead you. And in as much as he imitates Christ, you're to imitate him and you're to follow him. Isn't that helpful? Don't you think that's helpful? I think about our homes as well. I think about, well, let me say two, just the joy of being Presbyterian is all the shepherds, the elders of the church together. We're supposed to make this congregation feel secure in our leadership. Now, one way you can try to do that, that will utterly fail, is to convince the congregation that you are perfect. Good luck with that. Also given the fact that there are women in this church who are married to the men who are on that session. And so it's just really a tough sell. No, the way you give the congregation confidence is you act with faithfulness. You act with faithfulness in shepherding the lives of the people, in shepherding the life of the church, in the teaching of the church, guarding the pulpit. It was important to your confidence in the session that you get to know Austin before we called him and see, oh, this is a godly man. This is a man who desires to be faithful. This is a man who desires to work in ministry the way that we believe God has called us. It's important to have that. Now take that home. Mom, they need to feel secure in you. They need to feel that mom has an eye on faithfulness and walks towards faithfulness and wants that for them and brings them alongside in that. They don't need to feel that mom is erratic and whipped around by the world, unsteady, unstable. They need mom to be secure in that leadership in the home. And husbands and fathers, our whole households need that. Our children need it, but our wives need that as well. They need to feel secure in us. Not some pretend perfection. That does just the opposite. Somebody who thinks they never make a mistake, you don't feel secure in them at all. You don't think they're attached to reality. They need to feel secure in us. It's so instructive, or should be to us, that as God puts the Ark of the Covenant out in front, as God puts his stamp on the fact that God will work this miracle, God will deliver this promise, God will bring his people into the promised land, God is sovereign, God, 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 God. And then we get this tiny little interview or interlude where it's like, and Joshua, you should feel secure in your leadership and the people should feel secure in you. They should be eager to follow you because you are following me. And when we mess that up, what does faithfulness look like? Admitting it. Admitting it. Repenting of it. Turning away from it. Feeling sorrow for the hurt that it has caused, the insecurity and instability that created in our home or in our relationship. That's what faithfulness looks like. I think it's such a neat little interlude here that we get this moment about Joshua in the middle of what is otherwise five chapters on the power and sovereignty of God. All right, let's go to the next part. Amanda, will you read verses 10 through 13?
Sure. Joshua said, "Here's how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing before you into the Jordan. Now therefore take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man. And when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap. So when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan, with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as soon as those bearing the Ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the Ark were dipped in the brink of the water, now the Jordan overflows all its bank throughout the time of harvest."
Scripture uses a lot of if-then statements. And sometimes I wonder if we need to cement some if-then statements in our minds and our way of thinking. This one is, if God can stop up the Jordan, he can put down the Girgashite. I mean, that's a pretty... If God can do that, he can do this other thing. If God can get you into the land, he can surely give you the land. He's just repeating these examples for his people. If God is able to do this thing that you recognize would take miraculous power, then why should you be afraid of this other thing that if it's what God wants, all it needs is his miraculous power and he'll get it done? Can you think of anywhere in the New Testament that uses similar if-then logic that might be valuable for our thinking? Somebody flip to Romans 8 real quick. John 8:32.
"He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things?"
I don't know, guys. That's a pretty tough one. When I want to doubt what God can and will do, when in my flesh I get worried about what's going to happen, when my fears start to kick in, doubt the promises of God, And then I try to think of an if-then statement, and it'd be pretty good if the if-then statement I had was, if God will part the sea for you to walk through it, then how could he not? That'd be a pretty good one to have. Right? Is that the one you have? You've got, if he would not spare his own son. And we walk around, and I get it. I'm not criticizing the emotion. I get the emotion. But we walk around thinking, God is against me because there are no parking spots. God is against me because I'm having to have this conversation with my child for the 17th time. God is against me because my husband is still mean when he's tired. God is against me because I can't get into this friend group at school. God is against me because I get it. I 100% get the emotion. I am not mocking it whatsoever. I've probably had it this morning. If he would not spare his own son, how can I finish that sentence, God is against me? Maybe what we need is an if-how statement. If God acts like this, how can I walk through life thinking God is something other than that? He's faithful in his word. He's faithful in his actions. Takes on human flesh. Doesn't spare his own son. Raises him up for us. And then we say, yeah, but if God really liked me, I would have gotten blah, blah, blah. There's an absolute assurance of God's power here in these if-then statements. Davis writes, the rescue at the Red Sea, the crossing of the Jordan, and the death of and resurrection of Christ are explosions of God's power meant to color the whole horizon of the believer's life, to assure us that the God who so mightily handles great emergencies is surely adequate for the anxieties that beset us. Having your back to the sea while Pharaoh's armies are coming is a pretty great emergency. And God looks down and says, I got this. Getting to the edge of the promised land and there's a river and Moses is dead is a pretty great emergency. And God looks down and says, I've got this. And so I ask us, what's the anxiety that we had this week that kind of might feel a little bit silly now when we think about it in this light? God is not merely a three-letter word of our Christian jargon. It is the living God who works and intervenes and comes and saves and rescues and counsels his people in all their perplexities. Why does the Bible use Yahweh so much for God? Why does God use Yahweh so much? Why doesn't it just say God? Why does it say Yahweh? Because it's not just a three-letter word. It's a living God. It's the faithful God. It's the God of Hesed. It's the God who is super abundant in his goodness and covenant faithfulness. And every time you see God's name, you should remember that. And every time we go to God in prayer, no matter where we are, when we go into worship, no matter where we are, we can bring all kinds of stuff into worship. We can bring a good week, walking in relative holiness, thankful for our relationships, and eager to meet with God. We can bring that into worship. What percentage of the Sundays is that the you that you bring into worship? Don't answer that. It's slightly less than 100. We'll say that. You can also drag yourself in there. Lord, the only reason that I'm here is I feel like I'm supposed to be here, and I don't feel good about this, and I'm not happy about myself, and I'm not happy about the week, and I'm not happy about these people sitting around me, and I'm not happy about this first song that we're singing, and I'm not... But do you believe God will show up in there? And if you believe God will show up in there, what's in you doesn't matter all that much, because he has the power to change it. The power to change it. That's why we show up. We show up because God deserves it, but sometimes we show up either explicitly or implicitly begging God to use his power to change something. And he can. And he does. And we have these constant assurances of God's power. All right, I want to get to this last section before the sermon. This lesson's going to take 2 weeks, clearly. but I want to get to this before we go into the sermon text. Austin, will you read 14 through 17?
So when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan with the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and soon as those bearing the Ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priest bearing the Ark were dipped in the brink of the water, now the Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the time of the harvest, the waters coming down from above stood and rose in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zarethan, and those flowing down towards the sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, were completely cut off. The people passed over opposite Jericho. Now the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan. And all Israel was passing over on dry ground until all the nation finished passing over the Jordan.
Do you hear what the author does there? That's the part I was talking about at the very beginning. We're building up to this climatic moment. The people set out from their tents to cross, and the priests and the bearers of the ark are before the people. And when the bearers of the ark came to the Jordan, and the feet of the priests, the bearers of the ark, they're dipped in the edge of the water. You literally have your toes in the water at this point in the story. And then what happens at the end of verse 15? Now the Jordan overflows its banks all the days of the harvest. What? What is this? Who tells a story this way? You got to understand the river to appreciate the miracle. You got to understand the circumstances to appreciate the unexpected, extraordinary power of God in overcoming those circumstances. When the Jordan overflows its banks in harvest time, this is not like a sandy beach riverbank you've been to where you camp out with your towel and you get ready to go swimming on the side of the river. This is like a jungle. There is a massive overgrowth of stuff. There's a huge drop in elevation. This is not going through a peaceful stream shooting the hooch in the middle of the summer. This is a raging torrent that is probably a mile wide with a mass of jumbled brush and growth everywhere in between. This is a big deal. Why do you need that detail? Because that detail is important. Because it's not like that year long. Because there are times of the year where it wouldn't be such a big deal to cross this river. And yet what we have here is the absolute most difficult time, probably just in God's sense of humor, the most difficult single day of the year to cross this river. Why does God bring his people to the river on the most difficult day of the year to cross the river?
Because he's not worried. Because it also proves that even at the worst time of the river.
Can I ask you something else then? Why is your life so hard sometimes? Well, my life is easy. I kind of vaguely remember that I serve a powerful God who works miracles. And when my life is not easy, and I trace a thread of faithfulness and protection and provision through those really not difficult times, I remember that a little better, don't I? It paints more vividly on the canvas of my life the power and the goodness of God. If my life is something that I can handle, I actually think I'm the one who handled it. I can go through entire weeks and months and sometimes even years fooling myself to believe that I'm handling this life. I'm doing it in my own power. I'm doing it in my own strength, my own wisdom. I got where I am from a series of good decisions. And then something will come that, just like everything else, but far more obviously so, is beyond my control, beyond my power, beyond my wisdom, beyond my scheming, beyond my mechanics, beyond anything else. And God still sees me through it. And then I have to look back at all those other things and say, huh, maybe that wasn't me either. Maybe the good times were not self-manufactured and the bad times were a punishment from God. Maybe the good times were a blessing of God, a sign of his goodness. And maybe the bad times are a blessing from God, the sign of his goodness, so that I don't forget God. and so that I learned to be utterly reliant and dependent upon him. David says, perhaps he brings us into impossible circumstances, situations so bleak and hopeless, for the very purpose of impressing upon us that if we make it through, if we endure, if we are not overwhelmed and washed away, it will only be because of his grace and power. God delights to work in our utter helplessness. And that's tough for us because we do not want to feel helpless. We do not want to feel overwhelmed. We do not want to feel out of control. We do not want to feel like this thing is getting away from us. And that is in direct tension with what God loves to do, which is to put us in positions of helplessness so that we call out to him the way we're supposed to all the time. And what a great blessing. Because if he didn't, many of us would be washed away. We'd be washed away. We'd be utterly convinced, I can do this in my own strength. I have no need of God. I've got this. And we're like the I was going to say the foolish child, but this story actually involves the foolish children's father who is in Hawaii. And there's the black flags. And I was like, I don't know. I've been watching these waves for a while. I'm a good swimmer. And so I went out there. And it about killed me. There, but the grace of God, I'm 2 miles out. It hurt my head. My head spun. I got flipped over. I got a face full of sand. I got dragged out. It was the first wave. Because I'm some sort of idiot standing out there saying, I've got control of this. You ever done that in life? Somewhere other than waves? Stand up on the bluff like a prideful idiot and say, I've got this. And the most gracious thing God can do is send a big old wave to knock you over so that you look back up at him and say, never mind. I need your power. I need your goodness. I need your wisdom. God works in ways we are perplexed by. But you can often find these little threads. Now, don't confuse that with me saying you can explain them fully. I don't know why God does the way he works the way he does in many situations. But you can see threads of reasons that are a part of why he's doing that. And this is one of them. He will make us see our own helplessness because he loves us. And if he doesn't show us our own helplessness, we stand up on the bluff like a prideful idiot and act like we can do it.
Reminds me of a conversation we had in Sunday school a while ago about, I think the question was raised, when we get to heaven, will we know like exactly why what happened happened? And I think the consensus here was like, I mean, maybe, but that's really not the point of knowing like exactly why it happened. It's about knowing the God who ordained it to happen.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And especially now, if you hold on to that sentence Andrew just said, the point of drawing near to God in circumstances we can't understand is not to know more about our circumstances. It's to know more about God. It's to know him more. And it becomes enough. And I'm not saying we'll never know anything or we'll, but it becomes enough. And right now we tend to get really chewed up with, I have to know. I have to know why. I have to know why. The impression I get is that we will be so taken with God and with the goodness of God, it's almost like we'll forget that we ever wanted to know.